Okay, so I'm going to talk about E1 and more specifically Open Hardware Project, where we're trying to develop kind of a modern way of talking E1. And as you know, open hardware using USB. So, how do I go to the next slide? I'll start with a short introduction into E1, which I mostly copied from the Osmo DevCon presentation that Harald gave about. Introducing this project, basically. So if you want more detail about that, you can watch the recording. I'll just briefly go over it. So E1 dates back from ESDN, and it's a 2 megabits synchronous interface, full duplex. And in this talk, and in this project in particular, we're going to focus, I would always say E1, and we will focus on E1 support only, but T1 is pretty much the same thing with just a different baud rate. It's not so much used anymore in telephony. I mean, ISDN still exists, but it's declining, and everything is moving to IP nowadays, but apparently it's still used in a core network. At least that's what I'm being told. So, traditionally in GSM, in 2G and 3G at least, all the interfaces have been E1 or T1. In particular, the ABIS link nowadays is being moved away from E1 to IP as well. But even modern BTS still have physical E1 interfaces on them. And you can find basically the physical E1 being converted to IP by a separate device, like in the Ericsson, it's called the SIU. I'm sure other vendors have other names for it. The A interface is also being moved away from E1 itself, and 3GPP has actually a spec, A over IP, which is supported by the Osmocom stack. But in the core network, you still find a lot of E1, mostly because you have legacy equipment that needs to work. So why would we want a new? what would be E1 useful for us, right? Well, mostly because of decommissioned equipment. You can find a lot of equipment. Even relatively recent one that has E1 interfaces, and so if you can buy it for cheap, that's a good way to get BTS that are supported by the Osmocom stack, that have high quality hardware. It's Kaya grade, great RF, and for very very cheap. It's actually sometimes cheaper than you could buy an E1 card, so that's a good reason to develop better E1 hardware. So what are your options if you want E1 today? Well, basically, you pretty much only have PCI and PCI Express cards, which is not especially convenient, because if you want to connect that to your Raspberry Pi or to your small SBC, first, that card is going to be fairly expensive. I mean, like several times the cost of your SBC. And that SBC doesn't have a full-size PCI or PCI Express slot, which means you need to go to ATX motherboard or things like that, which is really not that convenient. So, well, easy, we're just going to make it our own, right? And so what would we want in that interface? Well, we certainly don't want PCI or PCI Express. The most convenient bus for us would be either USB or Ethernet, and we pretty much settled on USB. And it has to be small, so you can carry it around or integrate it easily. It has to be somewhat cheap. I mean, it's not going to be like $5 or 5 euros or something like that, but it can't cost like $400 like an official DGM card nowadays. Ideally, it has also to provide precise clock. I mean, the baud rate is 2.048, and we want it to be precise, because a lot of BTS equipment, at least the BS11 and other, uses the bitrate they receive to tune their own clock frequency, basically. And since GSM has requirements on the clock precision, we might as well integrate a good clock in that adapter. Okay, so we want to build it. We want those requirements. What can we use, you know, as actual chips? Well, all the E1 controller chips that have, you know, all the hardware integrated, they're not really an option because they're hard to find, because most of them are end of life. And even if I think there is a couple that are not necessarily marked as such, they're still hard to find, and they will probably be end of life very soon anyway. They're also very expensive, like, you know, $30-$40 for one chip. And they're not even that good for our application because they have horrible packages. I mean, by horrible, I mean like all, you know, like a large TQFP with 208 pins, because, well, they use very old bus interfaces with every signal in parallel, which means, you know, if you want to convert that to USB, well, not only do you have like a expensive large package for the E1 controller, but then you need something with as many pins to connect to that bus and convert it to USB, which is really not good. So the solution is to basically not use any of those E1 controller chip and just redo everything ourselves, and as much as possible do it in software, because, I mean, it's 2018, which means microcontrollers have some decent processing power. It's only 2 megabits, which means we can bit bang most of that. We still have to use what's called the LIU chip, which is basically just the electrical interfacing. You know, it's not a 0 to 3.3 volt signal. It's some special thing, and so the easy option is to use a dedicated chip. You can still find them, and they're still set, you know, as a say active status, which means, you know, they're not end of life, and they're not especially cheap, but they're not especially expensive either. They're like, you know, a little under between 5 and 10 euro, but they can make your life much easier. And they basically, at the output, they will just provide a bit stream, you know, with a clock and data, which is easy to interface to a lot of microcontrollers. So when this idea was first raised by Harald at Osmo DevCon this year, these were the three options that, you know, were discussed. The first one was use TI-PRU, so it's a programmable real-time unit. It's basically a small auxiliary core onto some TI chip that are meant to, well, basically bit bang some protocols. The attractive properties of this option were that you have like a powerful system on chip where you could actually run the entire Osmo stack and just have some, you know, interface to do the E1 in the PRU. And then you could have, you know, Ethernet or USB directly at the output, but Ethernet would have been the best option because, you know, if you run directly Osmo BSC on there, you could have your direct Ethernet connection to the backhaul and to your core network. Another option was the XMOS. So for people who don't know XMOS, they're like very special microcontrollers where you have several RISC, the core should be a plural here because there's actually a lot more than one, like 8 or 16 core running at a very fast speed. And the property of those microcontrollers is they have very few hard IP. You only have, you know, some version of USB, some version of Ethernet as hard cores, but every other protocol like UART, I2C, SPI, everything is implemented in software, which means you can implement an E1 interface as software as well. That's really what they're meant to do. So the kind of downside of it is that you have to use, well, there's kind of special toolchain, and they can also be, you know, a bit expensive. It depends which model, but sometimes a bit hard to find as well. Another option that was raised was a programmable logic, so basically FPGAs. Some concern that were raised that, well, it kind of pushes the boundary of what you call software defined, right? Because it's kind of software defined hardware, which is a bit weird. And it might be overkill for a 2 megabit signal because, you know, FPGAs are meant to process huge amount of data. And especially if you go to, you know, Altera or Xilinx, the vendor toolchain are not ideal, to say the least. And so with that in mind, this is what we went with, which is pretty much the entire opposite of the previous slide, is that we, Christian Vogel and myself, started to working in parallel on two different implementation. He's working on an implementation that used the Atmel SAM4S and the AD2V from IDT, which is that's the LIU for the electrical interface. Honestly, that's probably the smart option here. Like, it's the path of least resistance and the one most likely to produce reliable hardware. And on my side, I decided to try to use the ICE40 FPGAs, which are small, very small devices from Lattice, which have the particularity to have an open source tool chain. And I wanted to try to skip the LIU completely and directly connect the E1 to the ICE40. Honestly, yeah, as I said, just mostly for fun. Like, I just wondered if it was possible, and best way to know if it was possible is to try to do it, right? So I'll first talk a bit about, you know, how will that how will those two hardware options actually interface with the existing stack? So E1 and T1 support has been in a Libos Mobis for a while, and as was presented in the history, it started with MISDN, and then DADI drivers have been added. And kind of the specificity of that interface is that, from the application point of view, is that each time slot in E1 appears as a different file descriptor, and that's definitely something we want to keep in this new implementation, because it's very important, because different time slots will actually have to speak to different processes. Like, all the signaling stuff is going to go to Osmo BSC, but all the traffic and voice data or PCU data or things like that will have to go to other processes like Osmo MGW for the voice. So the best way to achieve that is basically with a daemon that's going to interface with the hardware, and that's the part that's going to actually handle the USB communication, things like that. And we'll expose some form of interface to the other processes. What form that process is going to, that RPC mechanism is going to take is still not entirely determined, because there's problem with buffering, because we want very low latency, and some tests that Al did with buffer sizes show that, you know, if you use like a simple pipe or things like that, you can actually have like 4K of data buffered, but 4K of data for one E1 time slot is actually a significant amount of time. Like, I think it's like half a second. And so we need some kind of flow control. But other than some preliminary test and, you know, this architecture diagram, not much work have been done on that part yet. So for the USB protocol itself, this is basically what we came up with. A couple of vendor specific for device setup. There's very little setup to do for this device. They just, you know, receive E1 and send it to the host for processing. For the data traffic, using Isochronos because of the real-time requirements. But again, how to handle flow control is not entirely determined yet. There is some support for, you know, for flow control defined in the specification of USB, because, you know, you have flow control requirement in audio, like, you know, for classic audio data, and so, but it's not, it seems pretty complicated. I still have to, you know, work out how exactly this is going to work, and so that still needs to be determined. All of this, you know, it's written in the wiki, but since nothing has been actually implemented yet, if we realize something is easier another way, it's still up to be defined some other way. But this is basically the way we see it, is that the device itself is going to handle the alignment, which, you know, it will align to the multi-frame structure of E1, find and check the CRC or add the CRC, that kind of stuff. and we'll send to the host frame-aligned E1 data to that process that will then, you know, demux it and send it to the various processes that want that or that time slot. So I'll present the first hardware option, which is using the Atmel SAM4S or microchip SAM4S, I guess, with the LIU. As I noted, it's mostly a Christian's work, so I'll try to be accurate in what I say, but I might be wrong. So as I said, it uses the LIU, the IDT1. We briefly considered switching to another LIU and one from XR that was, you know, slightly cheaper. Eventually, we decided against it, mostly because we already had an experimentation board for that particular LIU. Dieter had already done some tests and some setup with that LIU. Board were existing, people were playing with it already, so we kept it. The other one is like, you know, a couple of euro cheaper, but on the grand scheme of thing, it did not really change anything. Now the Atmel SAM4S has two important peripherals that we will use. Well, first it has hardware USB. I mean, if you want to make a USB dongle, you know, USB support is kind of important. And the other one is the SSC controller, which is like a flexible serial device to interface to the LIU. So that's the development board that has been done by Christian and on which he's working at the moment. So basically, this entire thing on top is the E1 interface with the LIU. Then you have the SAM4S, and this is the clocking. Well, actually, all of this is the clocking. That's the place for the GPS receiver, and voltage regulation and the debug interface. You know, complete with mud wires and everything. So, the clocking infrastructure. As I mentioned, we want a very precise clock. And so we decided to go with a GPS design because GPS receivers are cheap. We chose a 30.72 megahertz base frequency because first it's a very common frequency for a VCTXO. And the second thing is we can derive the two important clock frequency that we want from it. We need a 96 megahertz for USB or 48 megahertz, but the SAM4S wants 96 internally. And we can get the 2.048 megahertz by just dividing it by 15. The problem with that clock choice is that we kind of lose the Samba interface, which is like a debug interface. It won't work through USB because it's not one of the officially supported frequency, but it's fine. We have Samba over UART, so we'll use that. As for the locking to GPS, well, very classic design. We just take the PPS from the GPS receiver, we count how many clock cycles there is between them, and we integrate that to drive a DAC. It's not the most precise design in the sense that you only update the frequency, you know, every second, and you don't have things like phase tracking and stuff like that, but in the end, the clock will end up being precise, and that's all we care about. For the E1 interface, well, the LIU does most of the work, clock recovery and all of that, and really provides us with clock and data. We can connect that directly to the SAM4S SSC. For the transmit side, it's pretty easy because we just provide the clock and data, and it's up to the receiver to synchronize to the frame pattern. For the receive side, well, it's a little more complicated, but what we do is we pick a random alignment, basically at the beginning, and then we go through the synchronization procedure where we search for the frame structure manually in the bitstream. And once we find it, we can actually generate a framing signal using a, you know, an internal peripheral of the SAM4S, a timer counter, to generate a framing signal that will basically align the data from the SSC to the proper byte boundary. And what this allows us to do is that, you know, when we get the eight bits per byte from the SSC, they will be aligned, and we don't have to do any bit shuffling inside the microcontroller, and we can just take those aligned bytes and directly send them to USB without any processing, basically. USB, well, as I said, the SAM4S is a hardware USB. Unfortunately, that chip is not yet supported by libOpenCM3, and the vendor libraries are suboptimal. And so what Christian decided to do is to basically rewrite the driver, and that's something he's working on at the moment. And he got enumeration working, but he still needs to, you know, do proper data flow on that. So the option I've been working on, the ICE40. So as I said, the ICE40 is a very cheap FPGA. It costs like €3 or something. It's a fairly convenient package, QFN48. It's easy to solder. It's like 5mm by 5mm. It has an open source toolchain available, which means you can literally just have a make file, you type make, and it just builds your bitstream without having to mess with vendor tools. And I wanted to play with that chip, and my goal is to try to do a E1 USB interface with as little chips as possible, basically. I'm trying to basically do everything in the ICE40. So that's my development board, which is much less refined than Christian's one. But you have the ICE40 here, and then here on this little add-on, you have the 30.72 VCTXO. That's the E1 interface. I still need magnetics, unfortunately. I couldn't skip those reliably. And that's USB interface, basically, which is just a connector and a few resistors. So for the clocking, well, it's exactly the same principle as the SAM4S. We use the same frequency because, well, we can use from that frequency, we can also derive all the frequency we need. We need 48 megahertz for USB, and we can easily use, you know, a counter in the FPGA fabric to divide it by 15 and generate internally the 2.048 megahertz baud rate that we need. To control the VCTXO, I'm hoping to be able to use pulse density modulation rather than having to rely on a high precision DAC. The early test that I did actually showed that it seems to work pretty well and doesn't introduce like any spurs and phase noise or anything like that. And you can get a pretty good precision, like 16 bits of resolution pretty easily with only, you know, passive RC filters externally. So how can the ICE40 talk to E1? Well, basically, the ICE40 has differential IOs, right? And differential IOs are essentially just comparators. And so you can fix one of the pin to a reference voltage and use the other pin of your digital of your differential input as a comparator to detect different voltage levels. And so I'm using that to basically detect the three different voltage levels on the line. I still need magnetics, which I was a bit disappointed about. I was hoping to be able to just use capacitive coupling. Unfortunately, although it works well for RX, when you do it for both RX and TX, there is kind of crosstalk between the two. And it can be made to work, but it's not reliable. And so I figured, okay, I might as well just use the magnetics, and at least that's reliable. All the E1 interface, you know, like the HDB3 coding, framing, synchronization, state machine, and everything, you know, implementing the FPGA logic, that's, you know, almost entirely done. I mean, at least all the hard part. I mean, the transmit part, I don't have a framer yet, but it's really just taking the data from the USB interface, adding the CRC4, and that's it, and all the basic blocks are coded. E1 is a little more complicated. Electrically, it's simpler. What did I say? E1. Oh, yeah, sorry. USB is a little more complicated. Electrically, it's very simple. I mean, it was basic CMOS driver, at least we're only talking USB full speed, which is, you know, 12 megabits. We're not going to high speed. And so, you know, CMOS drivers are fine. You just need a couple of series resistors and a pull-up. So that's really nothing. But you know, all the state machines and stuff like that to implement. Implementing it purely in FPGA logic is obviously doable, but it's not very flexible. That when you want to change something, you know, it's messing around with a VHDL or Verilog or whatever, and which means it's not easy. So my idea is to basically implement an SIU in the FPGA logic, which is really just receiving and transmitting packets, which would be essentially the equivalent of the hardware function of the USB hardware function that you have in the SAM4S. You know, it receives packet and then generates an interrupt to, in this case, would be like a soft core. I wanted to write my own soft core and CPU architecture, especially for the ICE40. And writing the soft core itself is not that hard, but writing all the tool chain for that soft core is a pain. And so I decided against it, and I think I'm just going to use a RISC-V. It's going to take way too much logic, like probably half of the FPGA. But on the other hand, it's not like I have anything to do with the other half. I mean, the E1 core itself uses like 5% of the FPGA, so I have plenty of free space in there. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. So yeah, this is very much a work in progress, and I'm hoping to make progress on it by the end of the year, at least, to try to get USB working and then try to connect everything. I know Christian has been busy this last few weeks. I don't know what his plans are for the rest of the year. We'll have to ask him. Here is a few resources, mostly the link to the project. I forgot to put it, but there is the original talk at Osmo DevCon, which is on media.cc.de, and the links with the various Git repository. So, you know, a couple of thanks to Christian for working on the SAM4S implementation. Harald for introducing us to that ID, and for some hardware and support. And Dieter for the initial test on the E1. I mean, bringing up the LIU, basically. And that's it. Thank you. Any questions?
So you initially mentioned that there were two options, either USB or Ethernet, and both chosen USB. Why?
Well, the SAM4S didn't have Ethernet. Basically, implementing Ethernet in the FPGA would have been pretty hard without an external PHY. And I just didn't want him to implement. I mean, when I looked at the wish list, right, that we had at the beginning, where was it? You know, it's being used with a laptop and with small SBC. I think USB fit better. Like almost all SBCs will have multiple USB ports. They might, on the other hand, only have one Ethernet port. And if we wanted Ethernet, like some of the recent switches, they only support gigabit, which means you would have to have gigabit, which is just annoying. So yeah.
And the reason.
Feel free to start a third project for you.
No, actually, I think the SAM4S has a Mac inside, so
oh,
you
really?
Could attach an external PHY, so that would be
okay.
Possible. The only reason why there is Ethernet on this wish list is because Dieter wants Ethernet, because integrating from that to that from Windows is much easier than having to write USB
right.
Device drivers on Windows.
Yeah. Especially if we use isochronous endpoints. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I think if we exclude Dieter's requirement from the list, the Ethernet would be gone, basically. But the point is basically that whatever software we create, this daemon that was introduced and so on, we basically try to keep Ethernet in the back of our heads so we don't, you know, completely screw up this path of interface if Dieter or others want to pursue that.
Yep.
Speaking about Dieter, do you know whether he made some progress on programming the PRUs in the Zitara? Do you know something?
No, sorry, no idea.
Okay.
For this ICE40, you briefly mentioned VHDL and Verilog. Which one are you using?
I'm using Verilog, yeah.
Verilog?
Yeah. I mean, because the Opel toolchain only supports Verilog, basically. But you mean you could program it in VHDL if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? No? Thank you.
Thanks.